Our panel discussion today, it's time for the Wednesday panel. We'll be focusing on the prevention of suicide and dealing with depression. I'm with Daryl Brown, who happens to be a suicide survivor, but is also an ambassador for the South African Depression and Anxiety Group, as well as with Romy Kaplan, who specializes in psychosocial well-being, not only with a master's in forced migration from Oxford University. Thank you very much. She is also finalizing her PhD, a candidate for a PhD in existential psychology. Stay tuned for this topic that is incredibly important, especially in the South African context.
This is Cape Talk.
Is violence, trauma and financial instability beginning to drive South Africans to suicide? Now, South Africa's suicide rate is higher than the global average. According to a WHO report, the World Health Organization, South Africa recorded 6,406 losses of life to suicide, which translates to a rate of 12.8 people per 100,000. That's the latest data from 2016. And the global age standardized suicide rate was 10.5. Per 100,000 in the same year. Now, suicide claims more lives than malaria, breast cancer, or the war, and homicide, and should be a prioritized concern. We'd like to bring that conversation to the fore. Thank you so much for joining me in studio, Daryl Brown.
Good morning. Thank you.
Of course. And Romy Kaplan, who is not only all those academic things, but also co-founder and counselor at the Counseling Hub.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning. I think it's important for us to talk a little bit about what might be causing the spate of suicide increases, which we seem to be seeing, and I'll look to you to confirm that for me. But we're seeing reports of a rise in suicides in the country, and it's important, I suppose, for us to talk about it, not only because there are self-propelled reasons that this takes us on, but there seem to be exacerbating factors in the country, such as gender-based violence, protest, economic uncertainty, job uncertainty, that are adding to this. And I'd be curious for your views on whether there's an actual causal link that we can create and how we mitigate that. And then I'd love to spend the rest of the panel really focusing on the solutions. Because we spend a lot of time discussing things in an academic space, I'm going to start with you, Daryl, if you don't mind, just giving us some background to your story. Specifically because we speak about the situation, but not always to people who have survived. And right. You, in 2013,
yes,
tried to take your life in London. Yes. And thank you for not succeeding at that. So please, won't you take us through your story, please?
Sure. I'd been struggling with depression since I was about 12 years old. And I eventually moved to London to study when I was 23. And it was just kind of like the last attempt that I could, the last thing I could think of to get out of that feeling of being a failure and being not enough, good enough, and being a burden on everyone else. So I decided to jump in front of an underground train. I said goodbye to all my friends in London and gave my landlord a month's notice. And then I packed my bags and went down and waited for the platform to be empty.
Just take me through, if you don't mind, you know, you're talking about feeling like being a failure. For most South Africans, standing in a tube in London, that doesn't sound like failure. What were some of the drivers of that sense, if you can recall that moment?
So I had my first romantic relationship in London, which ended after about 6 months. I was struggling to get a work visa there, mm-hmm. so I thought I would have to come back to Cape Town with my tail between my legs and move back in with my parents and be a leech of them forever. I just felt everyone would be better off without me. And I was so tired of waiting for this one day when everything might be okay. Because, mm-hmm. You know, when I was at school, I was bullied and really? I was struggling with depression and with reconciling my homosexuality with my faith. Mm-hmm. And so I really struggled to accept that part of myself. So I kept on thinking, okay, when I leave school, everything's going to be fine. Then when I leave university, everything's going to be fine. If I get more involved at church, everything's going to be fine. And I just got to a point in London where I was like, I can't think of anything else to fix myself. And I was just exhausted. I couldn't wait for this one day when everything might be okay, and not knowing if that day was ever going to come. It felt like I was just going to feel this way forever, and I I just needed to, I felt like I needed to go to sleep and never wake up. I just wanted some kind of relief.
So I can really sense the weight of what you're talking about. And Romy, I'll extend to you to help me unpack this with greater professional perspective. But you've describing, Daryl, two things, the internal fraughtness about homosexuality with your faith, but then that external expectation again. The visa, don't want to be seen as a failure, never mind feeling like one by having to come back to Cape Town. And, of course, the economic uncertainty of you know, not getting the visa in order to work. These are similar uncertainties and externalities that we're facing here in South Africa. And can you maybe parlay that into the South African experience for us, Romy? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the macro factors do tend to impact on us personally. The political is personal. And so we are experiencing difficulties with livelihoods, and more for the younger generations also fitting into their social groups, because they are now so much more publicly on display with social media. And people do come into the counseling hub with all these issues, and I think that the advantage of that is that they are then ready to talk about it and not keep it to themselves. Because what I'm hearing from Daryl is that he felt he was the only one in the situation. And I'm so grateful that he's sharing that today, because other people out there will be able to relate to all these different factors and say, no, actually, I've also felt that way, and you're not alone. And that is vital, really, in all mental health issues.
I mean, this attempt had consequences, which the fact that you're brave with a smile, you lost both of your legs in that accident, in that jumping. How did you deal with depression thereafter? And obviously now with, I guess, less resources at your disposal to face the same goals you were trying to run from.
Yeah. At first, I was very angry with the universe, and I just kind of thought, I couldn't handle life before. How am I supposed to do it now, feeling the same way I did before, but also without legs? But you know, a lot of I got so much support from my friends and my family afterwards, that I wouldn't have been able to get to where I am now without that. Also, I was diagnosed with depression finally and put onto medication, and I started getting therapy for the first time. And, you know, that's, I never spoke to anyone about my depression before, because I thought, you know, everyone else is dealing with this stuff, why can't I? And I did feel like I was the only one. And I also thought no therapist is going to be able to say something that's suddenly going to make everything better. But my first encounter with a therapist after losing my legs actually was a huge turning point for me, because, you know, I spoke to her the same way I spoke to everyone at first, you know, wearing that mask of everything is fine, I'm fine. But she saw through that within 10 minutes, and I would be telling her stories about my life, and it was as if she had been in those moments with me, knowing exactly what someone had said to me, exactly how it had made me feel. And for the first time, I felt some kind of hope, like, okay, I'm not the only one. There is actually someone who understands how I'm feeling and how to help me out of it. And I finally felt like that day when everything was going to be okay was finally in reach.
So now, that's something that you would see on a daily basis at the counseling hub, Romy. Would you be able to say that Daryl's experience is something that's familiar? A person walks in and says, yeah, I've got this. I'm going to talk to you for a few minutes. My problem is actually these three bills. Or I just need a job. And then suddenly you unpeel this layer of the deeper sort of, I guess, work that needs to be done.
Yes, absolutely. And I think the first session is the session where the relationship with the therapist is formed. And it's that relationship that's therapeutic. And people do on the phone with us tell us, the issue is about relationships or depression, something that's a big word that doesn't actually tell you about the story behind it and the experience that the person has. And once our client is sitting with the therapist, they have the opportunity to have a space of radical acceptance and listening, and in a space where no one's judging them. And then in that kind of space, we are able to be authentic. If we sometimes feel that we can't speak honestly to those around us, that is the opportunity to do so. And once that layer has come down, then the process of work happens. So Daryl did his own work, but he did it in the presence of somebody who he knew was accepting him. And that's when the therapy started.
And is it possible, is it possible to do that without that kind of support? Because I think many of us are saying, as Daryl went through, let me just deal with my own stuff. And I think we're all kind of walking along. Is there a possibility for people to pull themselves out the quagmire?
We do. We do pull ourselves out of the quagmire on our own. And that is actually the philosophy that we have at the counseling hub, which is you are doing your own work. Mm-hmm. However, we all know how much easier it is to give somebody else advice, right? Mm. We can see what's going on with somebody else, and yet we can't see it with ourselves because we are so involved and it's so personal. And those obstacles can seem very difficult to overcome. And that's why it is so much easier to do your work with somebody else. When you just speak it out loud, you're actually thinking out loud, and you're able to see the different spaces that you've got yourself into, the fixes that you've got yourself into, and then start to undo them. So I do really believe in talk therapy, obviously, you know. And self-help books have helped a lot of people because it makes you think in a different way, perhaps reframe your concerns. But again, it's the social support, feeling that the other people out there, is critical for any form of mood disorder.
Can I posit something to you that comes up quite, up to both of you, that comes up quite often? The statement, and I'm seeing it from a message coming from one of our listeners, suicide is a selfish act. What is your view on that? I think I've seen people who have been at that precipice, and I can't imagine it is possible to think about anything else in that darkness. And what's your view on that statement?
So I have heard that, and I used to think that myself. But you know, when I was in that dark place, I couldn't. The only possible way out of my situation, my darkness, was to kill myself. And I felt like everyone was going to be better off without me. People wouldn't have to worry. I wouldn't have to talk to people. People wouldn't have to listen to my complaints and my whining. People wouldn't have to support me financially or socially. So I think also, you know, depression is an illness, and it changes the way your brain works. It changes the way your brain is structured, and you can't see yourself. You can't see a way out of that. So it clouds your thinking. You're not thinking rationally. It's just emotional. So I don't think I don't think suicide can be seen as a selfish act, because for that person, there's no other option.
Is it fair to say that people who say that are selfish themselves and putting their own mourning ahead of your struggle to survive?
I don't think so. I think people who have a loved one that they've lost to suicide, it's natural to feel betrayed. It's natural to feel that this person was selfish, but you know, those are feelings that you work through eventually. And with time, you'll come to realize that it wasn't a selfish act. But I think it's natural to feel that way in the beginning.
Of course, I'm sure it's one of the stages. I'm going to take a break now, but coming up after this, I think I'd love us to turn towards some of our coping and mechanisms and ways to sort of climb out of the depressive space before we get all the way to the point of wanting to experience suicide.
You're with Cape Talk.
This is Refilwe Maloto on Breakfast.
We continue with our Wednesday panel. And we're talking today about suicide and depression. Specifically, we've spoken a little bit in the first few minutes about some of the signs and driving factors toward it. South Africa is facing a rising spate of suicides. And I'd really like us to talk about the prevention of getting to that point. I'd love to throw that to you, Romy. Sorry, if you're just joining me, I'm with Romy Kaplan, who's the co-founder and counselor at Counseling Hub, and Daryl Brown, who happens to be the ambassador at the South African Depression and Anxiety Group, and also a suicide survivor himself. And what a survivor. So, Romy, what are some of the tools that we can use for ourselves?
There's a lot of support for any form of meditation, and this can be biblical style meditation, when you meditate on something that speaks to you, or mindfulness meditation. And the reason that this works is because we are able to get some distance from our inner talk and look at ourselves with a sense of curiosity. And in a way, that's getting back to our childish way of looking at ourselves, where we're full of play and fun. And as we get older, we take ourselves very seriously. And to just create that little bit of distance to say, from saying, I'm a complete failure, saying, well, maybe I didn't do so well at that, but, you know, today is another day. I've done well at something else. I can try again. Just giving yourself that space to breathe. So meditation is one very important element, and it can be, again, in other ways. You can take a walk near nature, and exercise, if you suffer from depression, is essential. And exercise can be as little as a 20-minute walk around the block. It releases those happy hormones. So these are important daily chores that we actually need to undertake to keep ourselves in a healthy state, our minds and bodies healthy. And these are our responsibilities.
Mm.
You know, we have to look after our mental health. For every sure. day.
I have a caller from Heart Bay who would like to join us. I think faced something similar to this. It said anonymous. Do you mind if I say your name?
Okay, that one.
Okay, it's Renee. Hi, Renee. Welcome to Breakfast with Refilwe. Please let us know what was on your mind.
You know, when somebody calls for help, it may be a half a call. They might take what they know is really not enough to send them off into the other world. I called a family member and a friend, and I said, if I didn't call by 9 o'clock, well, I don't know what. The fire brigade arrived because they couldn't get into the house, and a woman who was a sort of lifeline sort of thing. What I was told was, I was drawing attention to myself, which is what I was doing, but I got no help afterwards. People around one should really be a little bit more careful. Mm-hmm. And I think if you get a call like that, the circumstances should be inspected, looked into. I was calling for help. I was calling for attention.
Yeah, I think that's...
But it was misinterpreted, and I got no help whatsoever from family, friends, or anything.
How did you overcome this situation? Did you end up helping yourself, or did you turn for help elsewhere?
No, I think I shocked the people around me right. so much, and it gave me the courage to try and help myself, and finally I left. But I was in a situation where I was finding it terribly difficult to leave. It was a matter of personal security. It had taken me 47 years to stop sucking my thumb. And that person had a hell of a power over me.
Well, I'm really glad that you're free.
And so this is not for myself now, because it's past and I've got over it emotionally. But people must really not tell people who are suffering, oh, pull yourself together.
Thank you for that. Renee, excuse me, Romy, I think that's something that's extremely important. We're speaking just now about the work that we do ourselves. But at times, you know, meditation is something that comes quite early and exercise is consistent. But there comes a time when you're really staring into the breach. What can loved ones do upon hearing this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, those are daily tasks to keep us going. But really, we do hit those low points. And I think it's very important to be aware of the signs, and especially amongst the young, school going, because the age of suicide, that's the second largest cause of death, is between the ages of 15 to 29. So we really do have to be aware, teachers and other people and parents, people in the situations to be in contact with that age group need to be aware of those signs, such as isolation, not participating within the social environment, feeling like people who are feeling like failures if they start talking in that way, negative self-talk. We have to be aware of these signs so that we can then approach the person and see if they need some help.
Yeah, I mean, what are they? You know, so I don't know what I don't know when. So when Renee says I'm looking for help, is the feeling that people get. What are telltale signs in a teenager? What are telltale signs in a boisterous, confident person that they're cracking inside? And you know, and the person who gets told, you know, you're stronger than this. You'll be fine. I unfortunately had to turn to the news, but we'll think about that. And please send in your questions if you do have them for Romy and Daryl, and we'll continue.
Someone who is struggling with depression, it's difficult to know what to say to that person.
Mm.
But I think just being there for them and making it clear that you are there for them. They're not in this thing alone. I think also, you know, for someone who is struggling with depression, you have to understand your condition and you have to go and research it. But just the thought of like, okay, where do I find this information? What am I going to do? It's so overwhelming for someone who already feels like they've got the world on their shoulders, already can't concentrate with the things that they are doing in their lives, how to add this one extra thing and like figure out your condition. So I think as a friend or a loved one of someone who is struggling with depression, go and do your research as well and let them know that, you know, they're not in this journey alone. You're with them, and you can kind of support them and you understand what they're going through as well.
For sure. I once had heard a person who said, just let me know if you need someone to sit with in silence.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Sometimes it's difficult for the person going through depression to even articulate. Remy, please won't you help me understand? So we're talking, we spoke a little bit earlier about self-care. Daryl is highlighting some of the physical attributes that you can pick up to see if somebody is flagging the need for help. Sometimes we self-soothe in dangerous ways through substance abuse, and I think Renee touched on that a little earlier. How do we tell the difference between a person who's just going through a tough time or just happens to have, you know, a leaning towards certain substances, let's say alcohol or whatever, or a person who actually is expressing a deeper issue? Or is alcoholism always an expression of deeper issue or binge drinking?
It is an interesting question, and we have a high rate of substance abuse in this country. And one has to wonder whether it does go with the sense of hopelessness that we were mentioning earlier in terms of what's going on in South Africa. Can we see a horizon? Can we see something better coming our way? And, you know, self-medicating, we all do it to some extent, whether it's through food, through smoking, drinking. But yes, it's good to stop and say, hold on, what is this replacing for me? How am I feeling before I take this drink or eat this food? Is it because I'm feeling a little anxious? Is it because I'm feeling lonely? And those around us have to ask the hard questions. There's no way around it, and be open to listening rather than saying, ah, everything's going to be okay.
Absolutely. We'll continue this conversation. Please do keep letting us know what your thoughts are. Call in if you have any questions for Remy or Daryl, or if you'd just like to contribute to the conversation. We continue our Wednesday panel discussing depression and suicide. I just want to turn to a number of the WhatsApps that we've received from you. And just if you were wondering, I'm in studio with Romy Kaplan, co-founder and counselor at the Counseling Hub, as well as Daryl Brown, ambassador to SADAG, the South African Depression and Anxiety Group, as well as a survivor himself. We received a message here from Dr. Michelle Martins in Century City saying, Refilo is suicide. Wow. Thank you for airing this serious topic on your breakfast show. Awareness is awesome. Thank you very much, Dr. Martins, for that. WhatsApp saying, I lost my husband to suicide 15 years ago, and now my son is on antidepressants with suicidal thoughts. I'm terrified it will happen again. And somebody else saying, why do some people who commit suicide take the whole family with them? So I'm going to just turn back to our guests, and I know there are plenty for us to cover. I might just start with that Dion kind of touched on it with his brother and son, and his own feeling low at the moment. And then this notion of intergenerational depression, to what extent is hereditary somehow contributing?
Well, the WHO feels that there isn't a genetic component. They haven't been able to find a genetic component so far. However, we do know that environmental factors impact very strongly on us. And so we, you know, what we see going on in our families. And if there is a mental health issue, then that could be genetic. So while the act of suicide would not be genetically transferred, our way of thinking about solutions might be.
And just in terms of thinking about solutions, you were talking about the necessity to focus on light and not get shrouded in dark. Just help us understand how to do that in doing our work.
Well, I'm sure that's very annoying for, you know, when one is feeling depression, and we're not talking about a low mood where you're feeling like, I didn't have a great day. We're talking about, as your listeners mentioned, it's really being in a very dark place and not feeling like there's any way out of it. And that's when it also can be helpful to do some form of cognitive behavior therapy, as we know, to be very helpful for anxiety and for depression, where we become aware of the way we're thinking. So, for instance, Martin Seligman, he's written a fantastic book on this, which I found to be very, very helpful. We often catastrophize something. So if I fail an exam, I think this is the end of the world. I'll never pass again. Okay. We catastrophize. We personalize. We say, I'm the only one that's failing and there's no one else. And therefore the humiliation and shame is overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And then we generalize. We say, there's nothing I can do that's good. Now that I failed this test, there's nothing I do in the world that's good. So those three forms of cognitive thinking are very unhelpful. They don't help us. They just keep us in a really dark place. So once we become aware of our way of thinking, we can start to help ourselves and catch ourselves. And as soon as I say to myself, oh my gosh, this is the worst thing that's ever happened to me, I say, well, it could be worse. I probably might have another chance at it. It's bad. Acknowledging that it's not a good situation is very important. And at the same time saying, okay, let me open up a little gap for myself. Let me just say, I'm not the only one who's feeling bad in terms of personalizing. And so that is the way to start slowly, slowly starting to see things in a little bit of a different way that can give us space to breathe. And, you know, people talk a lot about gratitude, which again can be annoying if you're in a very dark place, like, oh, please, please don't tell me to be grateful now. But actually it's a value that helps us look at things. So it's not in and of itself something that's going to work for you. It's going to be something that at night when you're lying in bed feeling bad about yourself, you can say, okay, you know, today I was really happy that I managed to see a friend. And today I did actually manage to get my, you know, hair to look like I like mm-hmm. it. Just small little things that start to help your brain shift into ways of thinking that are more helpful for you.
It's that chemical movement as well.
Exactly. Brains are very plastic and we got to use that to our advantage.
Correct. So these are beautiful terms to catastrophize, generalize, and personalize. And I, by the way, I vouch for everything that you say. It's not that I'm questioning it, but I'm curious to hear from you, Daryl. It's been, say, 6 years since you made this attempt on your life, and I can't imagine that the even as an ambassador for SADAG, that the recovery as well as just staying consistent and resilient has been easy. Have you ever found yourself post the event, as Romy is mentioning, and as some of our listeners are saying, there seems to be a resurgence of even on the antidepressants, even while doing the work. I'm still awash with this feeling of hopelessness and listlessness. How do you deal with that practically if you have seen that before?
I do still get that sometimes. I do still have depression and I'm still on antidepressants and I see my psychiatrist once a month for talking therapy. And at first, when I was diagnosed, I couldn't wait to get off the meds. You know, I didn't want to rely on chemicals to feel okay. And I wanted to just kind of be self-sufficient and do everything on my own. But now I've kind of reached a point where, you know, I actually am living a very fulfilling life. Even though I have depression, I have a great job. I have fantastic friends, good relationships. So I think it's very important for people to understand that you can have a mental health issue, but also still be happy and still have a fulfilling life. And everyone goes through ups and downs, and mine might be a bit more extreme than other people because of my condition. But I also, because I've been through it for so long, I know that, okay, it feels really bad now, but I know that something better is going to come. I know I just need to hang in there until I can get through this. And my medication has been adjusted. Sometimes when I've really been struggling or when I felt like I'm really good, I don't need to be on such a high dosage anymore. So I think opening yourself up to, like Romy was saying, plasticity, not just in your brain, but in everything in your, the treatment of your condition. It's important.
For sure. I'll close out just to say the best way for us to contact the counseling hub from your perspective, Romy. I know you've got the website, but is it easier to pick up the phone and hear a voice, especially if you're in a tough moment?
Please call us on 021-462-3902.
021-462-3902. I couldn't thank either of you enough for being here for our Wednesday panel. It feels like it's flown by and we've just touched the surface. Romy Kaplan is the co-founder and counselor of the Counseling Hub. Thank you so much for your expertise. Dale Brown, ambassador of the South African Depression and Anxiety Group. Thank you for your vulnerability and your willingness to share with us this morning. Please feel free to come back at any other time. There's so much we can learn from all of one another.